Mornings Live on FM 96.3 and AM 620. WVMT.
Welcome back to the Morning Drive, everybody. Kurt and Anthony here on this Thursday morning. The McKenzie Country Classic Hotline is open as always, 888-414-0303. And joining us in studio now, we always love him coming in, it's Rob Roper. Good morning, Rob.
Morning, guys. Good to see you.
Thanks for coming in this morning. We got a lot going on, Rob.
Oh, we do. We do. God, they're coming to the end.
They're coming to the end. Yeah. But before we get into all that, because I don't always get a fellow Yankee fan on the show, although the new president of the Burlington City Council is a Yankee fan.
So excellent.
I think that was a big pickup. We got back to the last one was me. There's been two city council presidents since. Now we're back to a Yankee fan in the president's chair.
So there's hope for the future.
There you go.
Right.
But Rob, I think, did you go to Yankee Stadium, not opening day, but the second day?
I did. The first Saturday game at the stadium, it was a gift from my kids, which is, you know, I've succeeded as a father. I've raised two diehard Yankee fans.
Nice.
And there was a little period in there. There was a little period in there in their tweens when I thought maybe I lost them, but my daughter moved to Manhattan.
They were in the rebellious phase a little bit?
They were in their rebellious phase. My son gave up baseball for lacrosse for a few years and it nearly broke my heart.
It could have been worse. She could have moved to Boston.
No, my daughter is a New York Manhattanite, born and bred, I guess. I mean, I don't know where she gets it from. I love the teams. I used to work in the city, but I could never live there. But she loves it and she knows more about the players than me at this point. And
you did raise her right.
Yeah. So that was a gift from them, and we went, and it was a little chilly, but it was a great game. Yankees ended up winning 9-8. More drama at the end than I might have liked, but we saw one of Aaron Judge's home runs. We saw Giancarlo Stanton home run. It was a good game.
I was watching and I knew you were there. So where were your seats?
My kids wrangled some great seats. We were actually in the second level, right behind home plate.
Oh, nice.
When we get to a break, I'll show you the picture of the view. It was just spectacular.
Cool. Yeah. So. Well, they're off and running, and they're, I think, 13-6 now, and 140-something games left to go. So it's a long season, so we'll see what happens, but it's off to a good start. All right, Rob, so we are, as you mentioned, winding toward the finish line, maybe 3 or 4 weeks left, if it goes the way we hope it goes. One of your latest columns was about the clean heat standard, and I know you've written about that before. Tell us give us the gist of what you're saying on this clean heat standard now. It looks like they are not going to be able to meet their goals, according to what you've written, which was that they would be voting on some of this by January of 2025.
Well, in statute, the legislature has to vote on the rules in January 2025, and the PUC is supposed to present their draft plan in middle of September of this year. So it's not very far away. I mean, if you consider that they had to create two advisory committees, a 15-person committee, technical advisory group, and a 10-person committee, equity advisory group, to help the PUC put together the plan for how this thing is supposed to work. Well, last June, when the bill passed and it became law, the PUC took the reins of putting together the plan. It's taken them 7 months just to put those seven of the 15 months just to put those two committees together. Now those two committees have to figure out how to do what they're supposed to do. And it's been 2 months since that process has started. And they really haven't accomplished anything in terms of making decisions about who owns a credit. You know, this is a carbon credit scheme, basically. So the first thing you got to determine, who owns the credit? Is it the person who pays for the heat pump to be installed or the building to be weatherized? You know, here's my receipt. Where's my carbon credit for doing this clean heat measure? Or is it the person or business that install it? How does it get to the obligated party? That's an easy – it should be a fairly simple question. It's not as simple as it seems if you watch the debate. It's, you know, it's very nuanced. But they can't even decide that. And
why is it so hard, do you think,
for them? Because you've got 15 people on the tag. You've got 26 people working at the Public Utilities Commission. You've got the 10 people working on this other thing. And they all have very disparate views. And, you know, the fuel dealers, they want them to own the credit. You know, if I install the heat pump, I'm the one who's got to ultimately be the obligated party who has to own the credit. So I want the credit. But, you know, and I'm very sympathetic to the fuel dealers
well,
and all
that. Well, I was
going
to say, isn't that on the surface of the bill, that was the way they described it to people. You know, these fuel dealers are going to have to transition, and this is how we're going to help them transition. And so I thought it was outlined in the bill the way they talked about it when they passed it. Well, if you sell oil and you put a heat pump in, then you're going to get a credit. You're going to have to buy this credit from some other entity.
Yep.
But so they don't even they still haven't decided who's even going to own the credit.
They haven't decided who's going to own the credit. And that's the easiest thing to do. The next thing that they have to decide is how a credit is valued.
Yeah.
And you talk about complicated. The way the law says that this is supposed, if they can't even agree on who owns the credit, how are they going to agree on how a carbon credit is valued? Because in the law, it says it's supposed to be based on the amount of carbon dioxide or greenhouse gases that that the measure of installing a heat pump or weatherizing a building, there's 12 different categories that work for this, how much it will prevent from going into the atmosphere over the life of the 15, if it's got a 15-year life for a heat pump over that 15 years. That is wicked, wicked complicated to figure out.
Yeah. And then of course, the other side of the coin is you've got these credits, but then you've got a whole group of people. We still have to figure out who can sell credits. And they've been juxtaposition. They've been kind of moving the chess pieces on what's considered a green credit or not a green credit. So that whole side, have they addressed any of that?
No, they haven't addressed any of that. It's, you know, is biomass count as credit?
Right.
Do you get credit for biomass, or do you have to buy credits for producing? I mean, you talk about a quagmire of special interests coming in to weigh in on that one.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I've been saying this since they were debating it, and finally somebody came into the technical it was a technical advisory group or the equity advisory group. This guy with an Australian accent who's credited himself with having worked for international credit exchanges. I tried to verify and I couldn't. But he made a point that I've been making for a long time, which is this is a financial instrument that you're creating.
Yeah.
And it's as such, it needs to be regulated as a financial instrument because it's got a monetary value to it. It's basically a cryptocurrency. And like Bitcoin, you know, Bitcoin, you go out, you get a Bitcoin after you mine. I shouldn't have used this example because I don't understand it well enough. But you go out and you do something to generate a Bitcoin. And then when it's verified that you did the thing, you get the Bitcoin. Well, it's sort of the same thing. And how they're going to regulate this in such a way that it is kosher with like the SEC is in 5 months with these two groups that meet twice a month. Forget it.
It's not going to happen. Not to mention that unlike Bitcoin, it has a direct impact on multiple people's lives right here in Vermont.
Oh, it's even more you're exactly right, Anthony. It's even more complicated than Bitcoin.
Yeah, and there's a direct impact. Let's go to the phones. Good morning. You're live on the Morning Drive.
Good morning, Rob. I understand you oppose this. You've made that clear, and that's obviously fine. But is Vermont the first state to do something like this? And if not, why can't we look to what other states have done or other countries have done? Or are we out front on this issue?
Fair question.
It's
a great question.
Well, we are out on front on this issue in a big way.
Has any other state done something similar?
Yes, there's the Western Climate Initiative with it's California, and it's either Oregon or Washington, and there's a Canadian province that takes part in it. I will point out that those two states have the highest fuel prices outside of everybody but Hawaii. But here's the difference between what we're trying to do and what they're trying to do is they issue – and the other thing that's been compared to is the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. Those programs issue credits that are bought. This is the difference between mining credits like Bitcoin
or earning them, and
issuing like a fiat currency.
Right.
So what they do, like in Reggie, they say, okay, we need to have so much money come in. We're going to issue 15,000 credits, and the dozen or so utilities are going to come in and buy these credits at an auction. And we're going to do this on a quarterly basis. And that is a far simpler way of going about it. What we're saying is tens of thousands of people around the state are going to be installing heat pumps, weatherizing homes, putting hydrogen in. Again, 12 categories. Somebody has to verify that every single one of those things takes place. They have to calculate how much CO2 each action is going to take out of the atmosphere. They are then going to have to assign a credit value to that thing. They're going to have to assign ownership of that to somebody and then figure out an exchange for how that credit moves through the exchange from the person who is assigned ownership to it to this obligated party who needs to buy it, and then they need to retire it. Nobody's trying to do that because it's insane.
Well, and let's take it to the next level. What about the people in the last 5 years who have done it just to, one, to save money or altruistically, whatever? How come they're not going to be compensated in retrospect because, you know, they did this without having to be forced?
Well,
come on, reparations.
Well, no, adding to the complicated nature of this thing, you can have credits retroactive to January of 2023. I'm in that boat. My wife and I actually put in a heat pump for her office over the barn last spring, and we spent a couple thousand dollars on it. Do I get credit for that? For writing the check? Does the person who installed it get credit for that? And how are they going to go back and retroactively fight that out? Okay, let's say that, okay, we own the credit. How do I get it? I mean, where do I go? What receipt do I have to show?
Well,
what,
maybe we need an entirely separate banking system with brick-and-mortar facilities in 25 towns around the state, and it'll just be the Energy Credit Exchange Commission.
Well, you're going to need that.
Yeah.
And that's a cost that they have never calculated. Not the brick-and-mortar part, but you're going to need an agent. The IT that is going to have to be purchased in order to set up this exchange is going to be phenomenally expensive and phenomenally complicated, unless we can find somebody that we can glom onto, like the Western Climate Initiative, or New York is currently exploring something similar, although I think they're going to be like us. They're going to find this is way too complicated, way too expensive, and it's not going to fly. And just my prediction.
One of the things it seems like it should not be that hard is the dealer registry. Has that proved to be something relatively easy to put together?
Yeah. The PUC did not need the technical advisory or the equity advisory group's help with putting together this registry. That was the first task that they were supposed to do. So it's like, okay, by January 31st of this year, they were supposed to have registered all the, in quotes, obligated parties, anybody who buys or sells fossil fuel, heating fuels in the state by that date. They didn't even put together the form for how you were supposed to register until 2 weeks before that deadline.
Seriously.
And a website for people to go on and do it. So they said, okay, well, what we're going to do is we're going to give you a grace period to the end of February in order to register. Okay. That date has come and gone. It was just in the last couple days or weeks that they posted the registry that they've got. It's got 115 people have registered, or 115 companies that sell fuel have registered. I'm remembering back when they were debating this in the committees, and it's a couple to a few hundred is the estimate of how many people are actually doing this. So they're not even halfway there, I don't think. And
let's get some calls for you, Rob.
Let's go to the phones. Good morning. You're live on the Morning Drive.
You know, I just have to ask, I mean, does any of this matter? I mean, should we really be talking about all the reasons why this doesn't work and all the faults behind it? Because AOC, Chris Bray, and grade schoolers everywhere have told us we're going to be dead in 10 years if we don't do something. So shouldn't we embrace it and do something?
Well,
yeah, I mean, right. He's right about that. I mean, I was in the Capitol when protesters interrupted the governor's speech a couple years ago, and they were screaming, "We're all going to die."
Well, I mean, seriously, they have been seriously brainwashed into thinking that. I'm not saying that the climate isn't changing. I'm not saying that there isn't warming. In fact, you talk to the fuel dealers, you talk to Matt Cody, you have them on it. They track this very, very carefully because that's their business. And yeah, there are like 4 or 5 days a year that you don't have to heat anymore because it's warmer. So they know. So I agree that that's happening. But if you read some of the more sort of down-to-earth people like Bjorn Lomborg, who's the – I forget his name, but Barack Obama's climate guy, it's like, yeah, we can deal with this, but it's not a crisis. We're not going to – the planet's not going to catch on fire. We've got other issues that we can deal – that we need to deal with more pressingly. And I hope there was some sarcasm.
There was, in
the caller's turn.
But there's also a point in it, too.
But there is a point, and it needs to be brought up every time. In fact, this just happened in Congress with one of the folks, and I wish that the Republicans in our legislature would do this more systematically, is, all right, is this going to do anything? If you really believe the planet's going to spontaneously combust in 9 years, is this going to stop it?
Right.
In any way, shape, or form? And the answer is no. And if you press them, they'll tell you, no, it's not going to do anything. So we're spending all this money. It's going to be billions of dollars on these programs to accomplish essentially nothing in terms of that goal.
I mean, and can a little tiny state like Vermont make a difference in climate change?
No, it can't. And, you know, we really should be focusing, I think, on preparing for the changes that we're going to get. If we're going to see wetter winters, if we're going to see more flooding, you know, we need to figure out ways to get our sewage treatment plants up to speed so they can handle this stuff. We need to get our bridges and roads so they're resilient to this sort of thing.
We do need billions spent on infrastructure. There's no question about it.
It's a great question. If we do all these things that everybody's talking about, will it make a difference?
No.
It will not.
Let's go back to the phones. Good morning. You're live on the Morning Drive.
Good morning. I want to be heard out on this.
Okay.
I have my degree in environmental studies. There was a time that I drank the Kool-Aid of all the stuff that the legislature has done until I started reading alternative sources. And exactly what you're saying, I realized all these things are not going to change anything that is happening on the planet. And so I've been beating a new drum, and I have not heard a single legislator beat this drum, which is reduce consumption. If you really, truly want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, the individual has to make different decisions about what they consume. The larger cars, the larger houses, I need a new wardrobe every 6 months. We are not shaming people enough about that kind of thing. If Vermont wants to raise awareness, they need to be campaigning about that. In addition, if they need to raise taxes, why not tax the people who have a 4,000, 5,000 square foot home and two people living in them, and you're heating that entire home for two people? That's where I go. Like, I'm not for raising taxes. We're already taxed to the hilt. But start shaming the people who are consuming gluttonously.
Okay,
that's my opinion.
All right,
and I think that's the quickest way to impact anything is to reduce consumption.
Rob?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a free market kind of guy, so I think that the caller makes some good points, and you know, a lot of the choices that I've made in my life and my wife, you know, are along those lines. I mean, we don't have a huge house because it seems kind of superfluous to have a huge house and heat it and all that. But you know, I don't like the idea of shaming people into away from some of the choices that they might want to make, because people can decide for themselves how to pursue happiness. I mean, that's you know, in our founding documents, you know, we're all allowed to pursue happiness to what our idea of that is.
Let's go back to the phones. Good morning. You're live on the Morning Drive.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Good, good.
A few thoughts. You know, none of the projections that have ever been made about climate change have turned out to be true. Remember the hockey stick?
Yep.
The climate is changing. It's not settled science. We've had a warmer than normal winter, but nobody points out we also had a cooler than normal summer, which goes against the prevailing theory. I'd like your thoughts on that. Thank you.
Yeah, no. In fact, if you look back at all the predictions about climate change, with Leonard Nimoy about how we're going to have a frozen planet, I think that was like 1979 because global cooling was coming in and it was going to kill all the farms and we're all going to starve and live in the tundra. And then it became global warming and it was supposed to be, Al Gore said that there's going to be no polar cap by 2015. Well, it's still there.
Hey, I bought a house on a hill in Ferrisburg thinking it was going to be lakefront property.
Oh, you blew that investment.
Al owes us some serious money.
You blew that investment. And their prediction that by 2006 there was going to be no snow in Great Britain. And, of course, there's snow in Great Britain still. All of these things that it's very easy to look back and say, were they right? Were they right? And they've never been right.
Yeah.
So why do we keep putting stock in the things that they're telling us today that are along these apocalyptic predictions when they've never, ever been right?
That's the point. Let's go back to the phones. Good morning. You're live on the Morning Drive.
Well, once you understand that the solutions aren't created to solve the problems, but the problems are created to implement the solutions, then you can understand just how evil these people really are. On April 5th of this year, NOAA came out and said that carbon dioxide levels are the same as they were 75,000 years ago. I mean, we're just ignoring. Nobody's ever proven that climate change is really a problem. I mean, climate change is over centuries, yeah, but weather is weather. I mean, this is absolutely ridiculous. We're just looking at solutions to problems that probably don't even exist.
Do you go that far, Rob? I hate calling people evil when they have disagreements with us.
Yeah, I don't like calling evil, but I think the caller makes a really good point that this is being exploited by a lot of special interests with financial interests in being the in quotes solution to this so-called problem. I was watching that, like the Renewable Energy Standard, which is another bill we had the utility saying, the way you're writing this bill, you're forcing us to work with certain people.
Mm-hmm.
And those certain people happen to be major donors to a certain party.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a lot of that that's going on with this issue.
But there are people that really do believe that this is the existential crisis of our lifetime, that they need to fix it. And if they don't, that we are going to face disaster, right?
Yeah, I mean,
they legitimately do believe that.
Those people are there, and they legitimately believe it. I think that they're being sort of encouraged in that to a way that is not healthy for them or society, because there are special interests that do have a vested interest in that opinion being prevalent.
All right, well, we got to take a break. We're going to check in with Fox News. Man, it's got the headlines. We've got the forecast for you. Then we're going to continue the next segment with Rob Roper. So if you're calling or you're on hold, sit through the break. We'll get to you. It's the Morning Drive on a Thursday right here on News Talk WVMT in St. Albans.
You're listening to the Morning Drive with Kurt and Anthony on FM 96.3 and AM 620 WVMT.
Welcome back to the Morning Drive, everybody. Kurt and Anthony here, and we're continuing our discussion with Rob Roper, which is generating lots of calls. We want to get into some other columns and other issues, but we've got a call that's been on hold for a little bit, and we'll do that.
Let's go back to the phones. Good morning. You're live on the Morning Drive.
Good morning, Rob. I have a comment and a question. The first comment is about consumption. There's no way people like Kurt would give up their 12,000 square feet. It's not going to happen. All right, and the question is, if this plan for the clean heat bill, clean heat standard, gets delivered, is it just like any other bill? Will like both houses, both parts of the legislature have to vote on it, and could the governor still veto it?
Yes and no. It's not like other bills in the sense that it is law. It passed last year.
Done, right?
It's Act 18. It's not a bill anymore. It is a law that the clean heat standard is the law of the land. Now, what's different about this bill is that the full legislature, as part of Act 18, has to vote on the rules that the PUC, Public Utilities Commission, comes up with in order to run the program. So the legislature didn't really define in any way, shape, or form how this thing is supposed to work. They've kicked that can into the lap of this bureaucratic entity.
Unelected, unaccountable.
Unaccountable, unelected. Now, normally, this would go to a subcommittee of the legislature called the LCAR, Legislative Committee on Administrative Rules, and they would decide it. But what they did in Act 18 in response to a lot of blowback was they said, okay, well, we will all act as sort of a committee of the whole for LCAR. And this is getting weedy, but that's the difference. So when they come back in January 2025, the legislature is not voting to repeal the Clean Heat Standard. They're going to vote to move forward with, amend, or not move forward with the rules that the PUC puts forward.
However, I do want to point out that we are required by law, because now we can be sued, to have something in place. So there's a good chance they're going to come back next year and say, well, it's so late, we got to do this, we don't have any other choice.
Oh yeah, I mean, of course, that's sort of the plan. It's you know, well, we've already invested a year and all this money into getting as far as we can, so we need to move forward with something.
And would it be fair to say that your only option is vote in a different legislature?
Yes, that's the only option. I mean, you have to vote these people out and replace them with people who are going to vote no in January of 2025.
Otherwise, it's happening.
Otherwise, it's happening.
Let's go back to the phones. Good morning. You're live on the Morning Drive.
Morning. Thanks again for taking my call. Well, people may not be aware of this, but our new mayor in Burlington is talking and has actually made statements that she wants to close the McNeil generating plant because it burns fossil fuels. And the other thing is, anyone you talk to that has a heat pump, as you well know yourself, people are complaining because it costs more for electricity. If they close the plant down, the wood generating plant, where are they going to get the resources to make up the difference? I'll let you comment. Thank you.
Rob, the McNeil generating plant has been a hot topic for a long time. Yep. And there's a lot of different opinions on that. And I do think that he's right that the new mayor, Emma Mulvaney Stanek, has a different opinion than the general manager of BED about the McNeil generating plant.
Well, yeah, it is, and it is kind of funny to watch, and it's because I don't live in Burlington. That's the only way I can find humor in this. Because
what do you think about biomass?
I think you need that plant to keep people alive in the city of Burlington, and
to keep people alive.
Yeah, through winter. I mean, you need to have electricity.
Well, the alternative is they just fire up the diesel generators that nobody likes to talk about.
Yeah, I suppose you could fire up the diesel generators, but are you even allowed to put in a diesel generator in Burlington these days? But you know, you've got environmentalists on the one hand that say we've got to stop burning things in order to generate electricity, and then you've got this plant in the middle of the most progressive city with all these legislators who are on board with the Clean Heat Standard relying on this thing for their city's prosperity, and they're willing to hedge on that. They're, oh, no, it's great because the trees grow back.
Right. It's renewable. They just changed the thought about
and,
that.
And you've got the, Kurt, you mentioned, there are people who are really sincere about this stuff. Those sincere people are looking at this and saying, no.
It's not renewable.
That's not renewable, and it's putting more particulate and greenhouse gas pollution into the atmosphere than every car on the road.
Those are the true believers.
Those are the true believers, and you're giving them a pass.
Yeah.
But nuclear, which is carbon-free electricity, you have to buy renewable energy credits if you want to sell nuclear electricity, but you get carbon credits for burning all these trees. It's the hypocrisy surrounding it is, as I said, it's humorous because I don't live in Burlington.
But
if I did live in Burlington, I'd be really afraid, especially when your mayor is talking about shutting down.
And the previous plan was calling it renewable so they could sell. They're going to be one of the largest sellers of credits, right?
Yes. And again,
it's money.
This is, again, what I was talking about. There are special interests that are really looking to profit. And Burlington Electric Department is one of those entities out there that's gaming this system to cash in big time if it passes.
It could be the largest seller of credits.
Let's get some more calls, although I do want to get to a couple other topics before we hit the top of the hour.
Good morning. You're live on the Morning Drive.
Good morning. Hi, Kurt.
Hi.
They Speaker, I really appreciate this presentation. Your smart listeners should do their own investigation, make their own decisions. He mentioned Bjorn Lomborg. Everyone needs to learn more about what he's saying. There's a direct correlation between higher costs of energy and increased levels of poverty around the world. And when there's increased levels of poverty because of high cost of energy, there's increased climate gases because of dirty sources of fuel. And believe it or not, around the world, it's still high level use of dung, but dirty coal, things like that. So Jan Lundborg is very smart about this, and archiving Jordan Peterson's shows. There's a speaker, Dr. Moore, who was part of Greenpeace back in the 60s and 70s, who has left the organization, exposes its deficits these days in their opinions about where they're going, and really comes across in the same way as Lomborg, that people need to make their own decisions about this. There's enough information out there now. Thank you.
Thanks for Lomborg's great, and there's several other writers who are along that same line that people should look into, and if I had my list in front of me, I could remember names, but right now I'm not being very good about remembering names.
But it's true, you make it more expensive to live, and then you have a higher poverty sector, and then they're required to do whatever they can to survive, and burning bad coal or even dung happens. Let's go to the phones. Good morning, you're live on the Morning Drive.
Yes, good morning. I just wanted to ask a comment and a question. 2022, there was a report brought to the UN where they found credible evidence that Vladimir Putin and his government had been supporting anti-fracking and anti-nuclear efforts all throughout Europe in the effort to drive up fuel prices. This was certified, like this is real. Do you think that Putin could be doing the same thing in the U.S. in regards to our energy to try to make us more dependent on foreign and to make us less fracking, less oil, et cetera? I'll listen to your comment off there.
All right, Rob?
Yeah, well, it certainly wouldn't be a bad business strategy for Russia to be saying, hey, don't frack, don't produce your own oil because... You're going to buy it from us. What he's doing along those lines, I really have no idea. But certainly wouldn't be a bad business strategy. It wouldn't surprise me.
Rob, I want to – obviously, that's a big issue, as evidenced by all the calls and everything. But property taxes, 20% increase. They've whittled it down in the Ways and Means Committee, I guess, to around 15. What do you expect to come out of this session? Do you think there's going to be any long-term structural changes? And also, what do you think of the governor's deferred payment plan?
Okay, first of all, they've whittled it down. They have not whittled anything down. They have shifted the taxes to pocket.
You know, I understand, but they whittled the property tax down with other taxes.
Yeah, but this is what drives me. Oh, we're solving this problem. No, we're shifting. The money comes out of your bank account. They are not changing the amount of money that's coming out of your bank account. You're only going to pay less in property taxes, but you're going to pay more in a cloud tax, and you're going to pay more in what was the other one that they tacked on?
So we got cloud tax. They shifted some to non-residents.
Short-term rental tax.
Short-term
rental tax.
But so, those could be two that don't affect you, where property taxes would be.
Well, the cloud tax is going to affect you. Most probably won't be aware that it's affecting you as much, because you're going to, you know, as you were pointing out as I was driving in today, that you don't see that 6% show up on your TurboTax bill. You're not going to be as aware of it as if you get, as Anthony said, that big number.
The big number in the mail. Yeah.
That comes in the mail in July. That they're not really whittling anything down. And this is where I think you said, where do you think it's going to go? And I've been watching the debates in the Education Committee and the Ways and Means Committee sort of back and forth. And they are not interested in lowering spending on education, because the Superintendents Association, the NEA, and the Principals Association, the School Boards Association, those lobbying groups came in. They shut down any talk of genuine reform to you know what we're doing in education in terms of, you know, staffing programs, all that stuff. It was they shut that down. So What they're going to be doing with the study, as far as I can tell, and what I think is going to happen, is they're just going to find new ways to keep funding at the ever-increasing level of spending. And it's what we're spending on our K-12 education is outrageous.
Well, and I did notice, I don't watch them all, I can't do that, but I do read the agendas, and I don't think they had anybody testify in either committee that talked about spending reduction. Everybody that I saw testify that wasn't a staff member or an attorney for the state or, you know, the joint fiscal was promoting, there's nothing to see here, folks. We just got to figure out a way to fund it.
Yeah, no, Scott Beck was coming forward with some interesting ideas. I don't know enough about them to say they're good or bad, but they were, you know, real reform ideas. Mm-hmm. And you had Scott on the program.
I don't think they stayed in the bill.
Huh?
I don't think his changes stayed in the bill.
No, that's, you know, when it first happened, you had like the Principals Association and all the my friend John McClary calls them the blob because they consume everything in their path and get ever larger. They were playing lip service to it. Yeah, we got to figure something out. We got to do blah, blah, blah. But as soon as real reform started, you saw the hard line come down. The hammer came down. We're not doing this. Go slow. Don't do anything that's going to impact our kids' education. Listen to those pesky taxpayers out there. So I don't think – in fact, from the legislature standpoint, I was watching the Education Committee, and Chris Taylor, who's a representative from Milton, said, hey, you know what? We should maybe have the independent schools come in and testify about how they deliver better education for less money.
How did that go?
They laughed out loud.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Why would we listen to them?
Would we listen to them? We're trying to put them all out of business. But you know, Taylor was absolutely right.
Sure, it's genuine.
But where, Rob, where is the big money? Is it the ratios? I mean, we have the student-to-staff ratios are the highest or almost the highest in the nation. How do you get to the real savings?
Well, I think you get to the real savings is exactly through you say it. It's staffing. It's mostly the number of people that we have. I think it's 4-1. I think it's one adult for every four kids that we have. And the national average, I think, is 9-1.
In Vermont, the teacher-to-student ratio hasn't changed.
No,
it's administration.
It's administration, and it's a lot has to do with like the paraeducators who like trail kids who have behavioral issues or IEPs or something like that. So you have a class, you've got a teacher in a classroom, and you've got a bunch of kids that have these adults standing next to them.
But even direct service people, even if you include the paras, it doesn't scratch the surface. The real money's being spent on 6-8 principals in high schools now, things like that, but they won't talk about it.
And it's the supervisory union level of the bureaucracy is really why.
Well, that's it.
I mean, we've got like 75,000 kids in the schools. We have New York school districts that are much bigger than that, and they've got one superintendent.
Yeah.
How big of a problem do you think the ratios obviously is where the money is? How big of a problem do you think the disconnect that voters have where they don't know what their local vote means in regards to local spending decisions? And I know they're going to study this idea of having a level that they pay per pupil to each district, and then, which I kind of like, but I doubt that it'll ever happen. And then if you go beyond that, it's on your local dime. What do you think of that?
Again,
in terms of a reconnection,
I think that you need to connect it. You're going to have a hard time doing that with Brigham. I know what Scott Beck was saying is that we need to define what is education and what is not education. And then the not education part in the school wouldn't apply, or Brigham wouldn't apply to that spending. But you're still going to have that disparity between like, okay, well, if let's say sports doesn't count as education, that's extracurricular activities. And then you have a town that like Stowe, where I live, has the resources to have sports. And another town that doesn't have those resources can't pay for the sports. I think you'll have people come in and say that is a violation of Brigham. And they'll have to fight that out in court. I mean, what I would do if I would have, as you know, Chris Taylor said, look at how the independent schools do it. They get a set amount of money per kid, Right now, it's a little less than $18,000 for a high school student, a little less than $17,000 for a middle school student. And that's what you get. And that's your budget. If you've got 100 kids, it's times 18,000. That's your budget. And you figure out how to work within it. And they do.
And all the spending that we're doing is not necessarily correlating to results.
No, it's not. I mean, test scores have been going down for a decade and a half. You know, well before COVID. COVID takes a lot of the blame for that. And I'm sure it has had a negative impact beyond what we normally would have seen. But it's the scores have been going down for over a decade. And the mental health issues are rising in the classrooms that we're seeing with the kids, you know, the anxiety and the depression. And I think that we need to really rethink how we're delivering this service. It's because it's critical to, you know, the present and the future.
Let's go back to the phones. Good morning. You're live on the Morning Drive.
Hey, good morning, guys. Just want to thank everybody for bringing up the taxes and getting this out in the forefront, because I know my town's talking about it more and more. I've been trying to warn people to put more money away between the school taxes, the home heating, clean heating act, and what's the other one? We got another labor tax for you guys mentioned the other day. It starts in July. It's like 4% on our payroll.
Yeah, paid family leave.
Paid family leave, all that. I mean, cloud tax. I mean, we're probably looking at this year, like you said, all the hidden taxes you added in. It's probably around 20%. Is that correct? At least more.
I'm seeing the taxes, but I don't see the math. 20% on what?
I'm just talking the overall tax burden percentage-wise on any person's income between all the different taxes, the cloud tax, property tax, the clean energy bill. It's going to be at least 20% for every Vermont taxpayer. Is that correct? Right or about?
I can't verify 20%. I know, but we have one of the highest state tax burdens of anyone in the country. I think it's around 13%. And, you know, if you want to count like the clean heat standard coming in, that's not technically a tax. So yeah, so with that, yeah, maybe it's around 20%, but I can't verify the number, but I appreciate the attempt at the math.
Rob, yeah, I want to ask you one more thing that you've written about before. We're only got a 2 or 3 minutes left here. You talked about this new amendment, which is in regard to enshrining the right for collective bargaining. Why would we need to enshrine that in the Constitution? What are they trying to do here? And I know it's connected to we're not a right-to-work state like some 26 others are.
Yeah, well, a lot of it, I think, has to do with this property tax issue that's sort of come up. Is one of the ways that you could get the total spending down is to renegotiate some of these contracts with the teachers' unions. And so now we're going to have this constitutional amendment say, no, that's off the table.
You can't do that.
we're not doing that. And, you know, if you look at this, it's kind of funny because they said, they used Illinois as an example of a state that's done that. Illinois is a mess. Illinois has the worst pension crisis of any state in the country. And that's saying something because a lot of states have pension crisis.
We're following California's energy prices with the highest energy costs. Let's go for somebody who has a bankrupt pension and follow their model.
So what they're trying to do is, if they got this in the Constitution, you wouldn't be able to make any of these changes. Like to the pension and other things, because
you would make it would make it much harder.
And certainly. Illinois is obviously an example they're using. I think Senator Bruth also used we could go the way of Wisconsin as a bad example, right?
Yeah, he goes Wisconsin's a bad example under Governor Scott Walker. Scott Walker totally reformed that pension system. They had I wish I had my article in front of me because I could give you the exact statistics. Maybe you have it there, Kurt, but it was they lowered property taxes to the lowest level that they've been since World War II as a result of that reform. They started running a budget surplus.
That's terrible.
They turned a deficit into a surplus as a result of the reform. I mean, and their economy was growing and student outcomes improved.
That's terrible. And if they'd had this in place, this constitutional amendment that they're talking about here, he wouldn't have been able to enact those reforms, right?
It would have been significantly harder.
That's just terrible. We can't follow that.
No, what a terrible pension. Idea. We don't want to have lower property taxes and better outcomes for our kids. That would just be horrible.
I remember when he was in Vermont, we had him right where you're sitting in this studio for about an hour and a half interview. And he talked about when he came in, he faced a, I think it was $3.6 billion deficit that you've cited. And he had some choices like, okay, we can raise taxes. We don't want to do that. He had a couple bad alternatives, and he went the third way, which was this other way of making reforms to the pension system.
Yeah, and it worked. Walker was great. He was my guy in 2016. I was so sad when he
flamed out early. I thought he was a great governor. And he made and he faced incredible protests. Remember, they basically took over the Capitol.
They did. They were, like, sleeping in the Capitol. I think it was that state where the Democrats found
a way with the Supreme Court to get around them.
Yeah, they went to like Texas or something. Didn't they fly like to that because they couldn't vote on it because there wasn't a quorum or some, you know, right. It was a parliamentary thing.
Oh, but it was crazy. But he enacted it, got over them, and made the changes and saved the taxpayers a lot of money.
And they did. And all for the good.
Yeah.
All right, Rob Roper. He always mixes it up and got a lot of calls. So thanks, Rob. When do you think the session's going to get over?
Including the veto session? I don't know. Probably sometime in June. But thanks, guys. And it's robertroper.substack.com if you want to read more of this stuff.
I was going to say, follow Substack. It's great. Thanks, Rob. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to check in with ABC News. Amanda's got the headlines. We've got the forecast. And we're going to be talking with Chris.